Text 51551. Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
This month marks the 75th anniversary of the death of Eoghan O'Duffy, the controversial Irish soldier, policeman and politician forever remembered as leader of the Blue Shirts, Ireland's version of the European fascist movements of the 20s and 30s. So what was it about O'Duffy that made him such a controversial character? What impact did he have on the politics of Ireland? And what of his legacy? Well, historian Dermot Farrity is going to answer all those questions. Morning, Dermot.
Morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for coming in. Born in Monaghan back in the 1890s, what do we know about his younger days?
Very humble beginnings. He was the youngest of a family of seven, and they were reared on a very small holding in Monaghan near Castle Blaney. And he lost his mother when he was 12. Some of his siblings would have emigrated. I mean, the opportunities were very limited there. He was educated locally at Lara. And he was clearly a bright young student. He was ambitious. He was one of that generation who were very keen on joining organisations, getting involved in the cultural revival, the Gaelic League, very active in sport, the GAA, and that remained a constant theme throughout his career, his association with sporting organisations. And he was clearly somebody who had ambitions for himself. Mm. He did toy with the idea of becoming a school teacher, but he opted instead to go into the local authority and actually ultimately became county surveyor for Monaghan and worked his way up through the ranks of the county council there. And that's where he is when the momentous political and military events of that revolutionary period unfold. And he's very much a part of that in Monaghan. So we would associate him very much with the Ulster effort of the IRA during the War of Independence. And that's where he's marked out as somebody to watch, somebody who's very capable when it comes to organising military endeavours, someone who's very ruthless, again, very ambitious. He seems to have been more of a planner and an orchestrator, but that could also be done in a very ruthless way. And he was associated during that period with authorising fairly savage reprisals and the execution of informers. Very, very committed to that job. And he was regarded by Michael Collins as being one of the ablest of the IRA commanders at that stage.
What role and impact did he have, Dermot, in the War of Independence and the Civil War?
The targeting of the Royal Irish Constabulary is a major part of the War of Independence, particularly in its earlier stages. And he was very much associated with that. And he's right back near his home turf in relation to attacking the local RIC and ensuring that, you know, Ulster plays its part, you know, very much associated with the Ulster IRA. And it got very murky. It got very, very difficult, like the War of Independence in so many different parts of the country. And he is somebody who is really determined to be seen to be in command, in control. There's a very strong emphasis on leadership and discipline. And again, you can see that continuity throughout his career. He's somebody who wants to be very authoritative. But the big question, I suppose, for him and so many of the other commanders comes with the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty after the truce. Do you go with this compromise, with this settlement? Most of the IRA units were opposed to the treaty, but he decides to support it. And when he takes on a cause, he takes on a cause. And he's actually involved in very frantic and interesting efforts to try and bring the two sides of the IRA, the anti-treaty, the pro-treaty, together. And that involves him engaging with some of the notable leaders of the IRA in Southern Ireland, people like Liam Lynch, for example. That ultimately doesn't come to anything concrete in terms of efforts to prevent the civil war. But that's, again, another stage of his career, because then he becomes very much associated with the successful prosecution of the Civil War on the pro-treaty side with now the National Army. And he assumes very senior positions, including Chief of Staff. And again, he is working very closely with Collins. Indeed, many would have seen him as a likely successor to Michael Collins. And he ultimately becomes part of the War Council that's formed in 1922 to prosecute this civil war on the pro-treaty side. And he becomes General Officer Commanding of the Southwestern Command. That's a very, very serious job. And again, it gives him an immersion in the enmities of that period of the Civil War divide. And some would also see an increasing hysteria associated with his language and with just the energy that he devotes to the cause. He again becomes very ruthless, and he becomes a very polarizing character. And of course, that year, 1922, had such an impact on that generation, whether they were pro-treaty or anti-treaty.
He also played a major role, didn't he, in forming the Garda Síochána. Was his leadership a success?
It was a success. I mean, we have to remember that and not read backwards. There's a tendency sometimes to view the career of O'Duffy through the lens of the end of his career, where he becomes quite a dejected and some would say pathetic character. He's a very determined Garda commissioner. After Michael Staines, the first commissioner, has to leave in controversial circumstances, he's there to buttress that new force, to establish it as he sees it, according to his own vision of what a police force should be. What is that vision? It's determinedly Catholic, conservative. He's very didactic in how he leads the organisation. He writes articles for the Garda Review about intemperance in the Garda Síochána. His biographer, Fergus McGarry, has referred to him as preaching the gospel of national virility. You know, he's big into discipline and obedience and hierarchy, but he's also a preacher. And he sees his mission as a Catholic mission, as a Christian mission. He leads the guards on pilgrimages to various religious shrines around Europe. He's feared, but he's also quite popular because he's giving the guards a status, he's giving them a visibility, he's giving them a discipline. And of course, the Garda Síochána, it is regarded as one of the success stories of the formative decades of the state. You know, trying after the Civil War to create a viable police force. He is absolutely central to that mission.
Is that when, though, his fascist leanings might have first come to the fore and maybe contributed to his dismissal from the role?
There's a sense that some of his visits to Europe would have influenced his political attitudes. He does seem to be mesmerised to a certain degree by what's going on in Germany and Italy. And of course, there's a wider European context here to the career of O'Duffy, what's going on in terms of the fascist movements in Germany and Italy. But what he's most concerned about is that Fianna Fáil might take power. You know, the great Civil War enemies. And he saw them as godless communists. And that's the other international context here. You know, he's a polarising character in what's a very polarising decade in Ireland and Europe. And he was contemplating the idea of a coup if Fianna Fáil should get into power. Now, that's knocked on the head by some of the senior characters within Cumann na Gael. But it shows you the excesses that he was capable and his rhetoric, you know, matches that excess. So Fianna Fáil, when it does come into power in 1932, is very suspicious of what they regard as the dangerous character. And they basically pension him off. They do offer him a sinecure on the same pay, but he refuses to accept that. And the big question then is, what is going to happen to Eoin O'Duffy and the opponents, of course, of Fianna Fáil? It's a fraught time. One of the mantras of the IRA at that time is no free speech to traitors. There's a lot of conflict between Republicans and Cumann na Gael meetings. And O'Duffy comes into that space.
How did the Blue Shirt movement evolve and what did he bring to the leadership of it?
It evolved really in opposition to Fianna Fáil coming to power in 1932. The Army Comrades Association is formed. Now, these would have been senior ex-army supporters of Cumann na Gael who think that Fianna Fáil are a threat to their livelihood as well as to free speech. This is the era of the economic war. A lot of Cumann na Gael's support base has been affected by De Valera's policies because they can't make a living out of their cattle exports. There's a lot of tension. You can see this in all the Department of Justice files from the 1930s where meetings have been broken up and you have running battles between the IRA and the Army Comrades Association. There's a number of organisations there in the early 1930s that, you know, eventually merge into what becomes a new political entity, which is Fine Gael, the United Ireland Party. And there are those within this new Fine Gael movement who see Eoin O'Duffy as their saviour, who see him as somebody who has profile, who has authority, who's associated with successful organisation. And W.T. Cosgrave, who's the leader of Cumann na Gael, kind of takes a secondary role temporarily. So Eoin O'Duffy becomes president of that new Fine Gael entity, that merger, and he's not a TD, you know.
Yeah,
and Cosgrave is the parliamentary leader and the chairman, but he is the president. You won't find that information on the Fine Gael website. if you tap into the section on history, there's precious little mention of Eoin O'Duffy. So this is regarded as one of the difficult periods of their history. But the great fear that Fianna Fáil had is that he would lead a march. He was threatening a march on Dublin in 1933. And eventually the Blue Shirts are banned. And of course, they have the trappings of continental fascism. You know, you have the Blue Shirt, you have the uniform, you have the salute, you have these communal gatherings. And it's a very threatening time. And in some respects, he actually does a favour to Fianna Fáil because they can shed their slightly constitutional image and be seen as the upholders of law and order. And then Fianna Gael itself becomes divided. Is this man out of control? Is the rhetoric that he is using dangerous to democracy? There are different wings within Fine Gael. Some feel that he is dragging them down a path that is ultimately going to do great damage to them, and they eventually sideline him in 1933 and 1934. But there are other chapters left in his career.
How did it all come crashing down? And briefly, what was his involvement in the Spanish Civil War?
He was determined to see the Spanish Civil War as an opportunity for an Irish Christian crusade. And he does form an Irish brigade. There's about 700 of them go out. Their record is pathetic. At that stage, he's increasingly alcoholic. He's a complete contradiction in terms. He was an overweight chain smoking alcoholic who constantly preached about clean living, about discipline, about manliness. And by the time they get out to Spain, you know, supporting the Franco effort against the coalition, the Republican coalition, they're just not up to the task at all. They actually managed to kill more of Franco's men than they do of the enemy. So he comes home a very dejected figure. He lives until 1944. G2, Irish Army Intelligence, are keeping an eye on him during the Second World War because some in Germany see him as a possible link to the IRA, ironically, to try and destabilise the British war effort. But G2, Irish Army Intelligence, remarks quite sneeringly that his main mission in life at that stage was to get hold of the next brandy. So he does become quite a pathetic character.
Well, was he slightly tortured? I read somewhere last night preparing for this that, you know, when his mum died when he was 12, he wore her ring all the time. There were also kind of rumours that he was gay. Was he a slightly tortured man?
He was a tortured man. I have no doubt about that. Now, some of his biographers would suggest that, you know, there's no smoke without fire. Like there isn't contemporaneous proof of active homosexuality. But there are those who believe that he did.
And he never married.
Those inclinations. He didn't marry. And some believe he sublimated his sexual desires into, you know, various organisations and the camaraderie that went with that. And his preoccupations were a part of that. You know, you can't prove that. It has been speculated by those who have been covering his life. It would be another manifestation, perhaps, of the great gulf that exists between the rhetoric that he espoused and the standards that he sought to set and the reality that he was indeed a very confused and quite tortured individual. And he is a product of many of those societal forces in the 20s and 30s and the repressions and the hypocrisies and the snobberies.
Finally, Dermot, as an historian, his legacy, farce or something more substantial?
No, it is more substantial. I mean, there's a temptation to conclude that his life was one of tragedy and farce. It's about much more than that. If you trace back his involvement, not just in the IRA in the earlier years in the War of Independence, but also his crucial role in the Civil War. And then again, perhaps more importantly, his involvement in the Guards, but also his sporting legacy. Let's not forget, after all, in 1932, he was a very successful president of the Irish Olympic Council for the 1932 Olympics. So that sporting legacy is still there.
Listen, Dermot, as ever, thanks so much. You're a fount of information. We'll take a break.
Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.